Okay, so this is lesson two. Some of you picked up the sheet before I changed it. I forgot, that's one thing I forgot to change on there is it says lesson one, it's lesson two, but it is the right verses, Ezra 3:7 through chapter 6. So I want to just review a little bit. For those of you who are new, you'll notice that I always have review on the top. It's always my first point. And that review really helps us to keep over and over and over again what's gone before, because it's always a foundational for what we do today. Sometimes I go over it, sometimes I don't, but it is there for you always to look at so that we can really synthesize everything so that it becomes down to one package rather than just all sorts of different lessons. Because there is so much, it's hard to kind of remember what's going on. So I do like to put that up in there. It helps me to remember. It helps even just to come up with, how can I put it in one sentence what we learned from that, or usually two or three. So remember, we're talking about rebuilding. And because we're talking about rebuilding temple right now, we're talking about rebuilding our identity. Because remember, we haven't gone through all of them. She will give you some, and we'll talk about some, but thank you. When they talk about temple, it is a foreshadowing of who we are. And we see that a million times in the New Testament, that we are the temple where God dwells. So we're rebuilding our identity. And we know that it is going to need, we're going to need to cultivate awareness then of God's presence in us. So not just God's presence everywhere, but God's presence in us. And also engage in that presence and in that awareness. So last week we talked about the fact, in order to do that, we need to revive our heart and reorient our heart. And it's really important that we first start with heart. Because if we don't start with heart, we start with our strength, which is our outer, the things we do, it will become ritual and obligation, and it will not be transforming. So we do have to talk about heart first. So last week we talked about three of the things that our heart needs to recognize. It needs to recognize the hope of restoration. And what we mean by that is that we understand, we are absolutely sure. Remember, hope in Scripture is an absolute assurance that this is what's happening now. Now, we have had a lot of theology in the last two centuries that says restoration will happen when? After we die. That's not scriptural. Bible says restoration is happening now. So the hope is, the absolute assurance is, it is happening now. And if we don't grasp that, our heart will start to do other things. And we'll actually talk about Ecclesiastes a little bit, because that's what Ecclesiastes is it doesn't talk about the heart being restoration now. It's this closed system. So we have to recognize that our backstory is that God loves us so much, and so much that he won't leave us in the mess that we're in the closed system that we've created for ourselves. He won't leave us there. He is in the process of restoring us now, today, this moment, with everything that you do. That is what he's doing. So we need to recognize that. We need to recognize so that we say, this is restoration. This is restoration. And I asked you last week to come up with something for yourself that would remind you, that would bring to your heart and to your mind and to your thoughts, what will remind me that God is restoring me right now, that this is restoration? How many of you did that? One, two, three, four. Okay, guys. Remember, I want you to always pass my sink there and see my little pig, because that's that reminder. That's what mine is that pigs, remember, were unclean, and yet God restores them, right, to be something that we can eat and enjoy. And that reminds me, oh, God is restoring me right now. That's what he's doing. Does any of you want to share what you chose?
I forgot to bring mine.
Bring it next week if you want. Chris, what did you...
You know, one of the... I loved this whole thing. One of the things that I've really been struggling with over the last couple of years has been fear and anxiety. And I've been using a verse to kind of recenter me. And when you said it's good to change it up, that just kind of made... made me stop and think about getting another image to kind of help me. And when I read that verse, his eye is on them, it made me think of my favorite hymn, His Eye is on the Sparrow.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
So an image of a sparrow.
Oh,
was what I decided.
I love it. That's great. Yeah. That's really good. Okay.
You want to share?
No.
I have a little clay tray that's actually a raku pottery. I don't know if you are familiar with that. It's where it's actually in the fire, not just in a kiln. Mm-hmm. And so just sort of that image of the potter and the clay, and it's going right in the fire, and it's something that my daughter had made for me. And so there's a lot of the imperfections are what makes it beautiful, and there's just sort of a lot of layers of significance to that.
That's cool. That's very cool. Anybody else want to share? You want to?
Mine's a blank chalkboard.
A blank chalkboard. Oh, I like that.
With, and as I was sharing last week, the verse or the song of I Surrender All.
Yes.
To be able to have that, you have to have life.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good. Excellent. Michelle?
My restoration was with the surgeries I've had and how it's changed my body. So what I carry with me all the time is my scars. And I've shared with you how difficult they can be for me. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to learn that it's, you know, it saved my life, and it's it's always there to remember, you know.
Yeah, right. So, right. So when we see you in short sleeves,
then you'll know I've made it.
Yeah. good. Anybody else? I would recommend highly you doing this. This is helpful for you. We are people, first of all, we're visual people. And we can talk about it all we want, but we will forget. And God gave us the gift of vision for some of this. So I would recommend that you find something that reminds you, this too is restoration. Whatever you're going through in the day, good, bad, indifferent, it is restoration. So that's part of us being ready for restoration, is recognizing that he is being faithful to you, to not keep you where you are. Also, we need to recognize the gift of community. Community is what God will use to restore us. But community also is what God will restore us to. So he uses it to help us, to have people with us in restoration, also to have people goad us into restoration, but also it's what he's restoring us to. So this week I had two interesting things about community. Actually, there was something, I read this paper this morning, and this week the Naperville paramedics had to revive someone from a heroin overdose. And they got to use the new drug that they have that helps them, and they revived this person. But the comment was, as wonderful as that was, and this is what it said, it will take a community for this young person to be able to again come back to a life that is productive and full. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because our thought is, no, it's on her, right? She, and maybe her parents, you know, they've just got to, but it isn't. It is community that is going to need to help her, to name her worth, to tend her, to give her space to flourish, all of that. So community is what God uses to restore us, but also is what he restores us to. So that was one of the things. Then I got a letter yesterday in the mail from Carmel, and she asked me to read this to you. So this is a letter to you guys. So I'm going to read this, and I thought, right there, that's exactly what we're talking about. So from Carmel, though it has taken me a long time to write, I want you all, translation, you all, she's in Texas now, to know that I've been thinking about you and praying for you often. On Wednesdays, I picture Jill's house and wonder what she'll be teaching, who is there, and what special treat Yolanda has made. I do miss all y'all, translation, all of you, and really miss being able to listen to Jill's teaching in person, but I am listening online. So she's still in class, and we do have a lot of our members who've left and still listen with us. I'm so thankful for the years that I was able to attend Bible study, and I'm thankful for all of you, the insight you brought to our study, and the fellowship we shared. Before and during my move, so many of you prayed for me, offered support, and even came over and helped me pack. This was such a difficult move for me. Jill's talked about a cutting away, and I truly felt that God was cutting me away from so many wonderful people, the neighborhood I love, my extended family, and the place where I spent the most significant years of my life raising my children alongside many of you. What made it bearable was all of your love and support. I leaned on prayer with God, and I could feel that your prayers were also supporting me as well. So much has changed for me, but God is faithful and always provides more than we deserve. I have a beautiful house in Texas and wonderful new neighbors who've reached out to me. A bonus is that the climate is much better than Chicago's. I won't miss the brutal winter, but she will be here next week, so she'll get to enjoy it. We have found a new church here and are trying to settle into a rhythm. I want to thank you for the beautiful luncheon you had for me at the beginning of the summer and for the signed wooden bowl. What a special memento. If you didn't get to sign it, you'll have to come visit me in Texas. It's on display in my living room. Once again, thank you so much for your kind words, prayers, and support during my move. I hope I'll be able to visit Bible study during the spring. That's community, right? Mm-hmm. Community was used to help restore in places for Carmel, but it was also what she was being restored to. And now God moves her, and she gets to carry that with, and is beginning community somewhere else, but not letting go of community here. So that was my first thought. Oh, that's very cool. But then, and unfortunately, Sherilyn's very sick today. She told us such a great story that I asked if I could share it, and I'm not going to share it like Sherilyn. You know Sherilyn, she can just really put you there. But so last week, we talked about community, right, and being aware of people's backstories, being aware of our backstory. So the day after Bible study last week, she was driving to get Sophie from class, and she has somebody starting to tail her. Have you ever had this where someone, they are definitely wanting to get you out of the way, and she said, this guy was on her tail, and he just would not get off her tail, and you could tell he just wanted to get somewhere fast. And so, of course, she did what many of us do. She slows down. And she said, just randomly, I would just tap my brakes, and she said, I didn't even care if he hit me. I just wanted him to know this was ridiculous. He should not be doing this. And he just kept tailing me and tailing me. And she said the whole way she was going, all the way to Sophie's class, which is kind of far. So she kept driving and driving, and he's still, the whole time, still doing this. She pulls into Sophia's school. He pulls in behind her. Now she's like, what is this guy doing? This is ridiculous. She pulls into the waiting zone to get Sophia. The guy pulls in behind her, gets out of his car. And now she's like, oh, no. And he comes and he raps on her window. And she's like, you know, she's ready, right? She is just ready. She rolls her window down. He goes, oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Could you help me? I didn't know. I'm so late. This is the first time I've ever picked up my daughter here. I don't know how to do it. Could you tell me how to do it? I was late. I was so afraid. And, you know, I've not been in her life. And I want to be a part of her life now. And he's telling this story like, and Sherilyn said, oh, my gosh, all he wanted was community. He wanted someone to be with him in this and help him. And could you help me? Could you show me where to go? And am I late? And what happens if I'm late? And he was just on. And, of course, right then she's like, wow, see? I didn't take into account any backstory, right? It was about me. And all he wanted was community. All he wanted was someone to be with him in his restoration process, which is exactly what was happening for him, right? He was restoring relationship. It couldn't have happened at a better time for that to happen. And I wish Sherilyn were here to tell you it, because she just, you're just with her the whole way. but again, we have to be aware that there is a backstory for everyone, and everyone's backstory is exactly the same. It's God is in the midst of restoring them. And are you willing to say, that backstory is attached to my backstory too? It's the same backstory. It is God restoring both of us in community. Or do I want to shut off? I don't want to be a part of your backstory. Get out of my way. You're hassling me. You know, no. I had something happen to me this morning, and I thought it was just irritating me the whole time. And I couldn't figure out why it was irritating me. And I realized I don't want to be part of that backstory. Just let me have mine and you have yours. And God's like, no, I think we're in community here. Fine. All right, fine. So we do have to be aware that that's what God is going to be using. It will be community. And you don't really get to choose what community. We like to think we do, right? And we want to. And we make all sorts of walls to make sure that we know what our community is like. Mm-hmm. And comfortable, right? I mean, this is definitely what we do. And God is going to, boy, he is going to knock on your window every time. No, I have community for you. I know exactly the kind of community you're going to need. So, recognizing that, but also recognizing then the gift of worship, which is the last thing we talked about. Remembering that worship is not singing before a sermon. That's not worship. It can be. I'll tell you, my feeling is it often isn't. Because worship is a physical manifestation of submission. So when you're singing, and when you're singing really loud and you're just into it, is it because you're saying, God, you lead. You know what's best. I'll be a representative of you, not me. Is that what you're saying when you're singing so loudly? Or is it something else? I don't know, and nobody around you knows. But we have to remember that worship is physically manifesting your submission. You're saying to God, you know what's best. You know what I need for restoration. You know the community I need for restoration. You know the circumstances I need for restoration. You know. And I will, everything that I do in my life will be a manifestation of saying that. You lead, I'll follow. I will represent you, not me. That's what worship is. And if that's what worship is, it is what prepares our heart for restoration. That means that anything we do in life, I'm prepared for God to restore me when I'm in submission. When I'm not in submission, I am not ready to be restored, right? If I'm not, Karen, would you mind getting that, please? I'm not at all ready for God to restore me in some ways. I'm not ready for him to rub off that rust. I'm not ready for him to scrape down to some deep things if I'm not in submission. Because if I'm not in submission, what I'm saying is, I know what's best. I've got it. I know the big picture. I know what's best for me, which is pretty much our normal stance, right? I know what's best for me. But worship is, God knows what's best, and I will submit to whatever that is. So that's kind of where we've been, and now we're going to talk about worship again. So I want to go, I want to back us up into chapter 3, the last couple verses. I should have got mine.
Are you taping?
I am taping. I want us to understand a little bit more about worship. Because the word worship for English speakers has connotations that are very narrow. And I want to expand our definition of worship, but I want to expand our connotation. I want us to expand the idea that we worship every single day. We worship in everything we do. And if we're not worshiping, we're committing idolatry. It's one or the other. All the time. So I want us to look at that. So when we get at the end of verse 3, or the end of chapter 3, we're beginning to talk about what the Jewish people who had come back were doing. And it says that they gave money, food, drink, and oil, and then all of them began the work. I want us to think about the fact that they gave money, but they also gave food, and they gave drink, and they gave oil. Where did they get all of that?
From the Israelites who didn't leave. From the treasury.
Okay, so this is 2 years. This is 2 years into it.
Yeah, it was just their own pantries, right?
Yeah, and where did that come from?
They farmed and
yeah, right. It came from all of their work, right? So what we begin to see is that work can and should be worship. Work is worship. At least that's how it was intended to be. What I want to do is let's just list all the things that you will do today and tomorrow. So everything that you do, just start listing them.
Sleep.
Email.
Sleep. That's an interest.
Very little.
let's not talk about the active. Let's talk about the
active. I'll be driving. Yeah, drive.
So
driving.
What?
Driving.
Drive.
Carpool.
Okay, carpool.
Well, taxi.
Okay.
Running errands.
Meeting
phone.
Posting.
Shoveling snow.
Practicing.
Dishes. Hosting your life club. Tonight.
Yep.
Yeah. Kids birthday. I'm sorry?
Drawing.
Yeah.
Almost. Long day.
Waiting at
exercise. Coaching.
She's making chocolate.
Making bits.
So cute. We benefit from that.
We carbless.
Can I text
you over?
Bible study.
Yeah, I was going
to say. Oh, yeah, the prime.
Is it still attached to the wall? Bathing little people.
Celebrating a birthday.
Your birthday?
No, I have a key.
Phone calls.
Babysitting.
Phone calls, right?
Paying bills.
Getting dressed.
Job that they're going to in the next year or two?
Yeah, our games are up there. Moving.
Okay.
Yeah. Are you working at the office?
Teaching.
I'd like to know some of the work that you do, some of the jobs that you have. Just name them.
Organizing.
Yeah. Training.
Teaching.
You try to describe our job.
Coordinating.
Coordinating is a job? What's the job that coordinates?
That's high school ministry leader.
Making decisions.
Planning.
Job. I just want big jobs.
School board.
Youth ministry. Mom.
Okay, I think we've got the idea here. We're going to deal with that in a minute. But all of those are jobs, right? All of those are work. What we do all the time is we work, right? We work all the time doing all sorts of different things. Our jobs, whether they are jobs that we're going to do for our family, jobs that we're going to do around the house, jobs that we do outside of the house, all of those actually will speak to what our heart centers around. We won't all know what our heart is centering around when we're doing the job, but they do speak to that. Because the question is, why are you doing that? Are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it for someone else? This is going to get to the heart of what's going on, of whether you're worshiping or whether you are being involved in idolatry. Why am I doing this? Am I doing it for myself? Am I doing it primarily for others or primarily for myself? Now, of course, it's going to be mixed. But the question is, primarily, who am I doing this for? So we have to start thinking about that, and I want you to start thinking about that. Things like, so I'm just going to give you an example. Bill always does the shoveling. We share it sometimes, but he mostly does the shoveling. And, of course, with the snowstorm that we had, you know, he was out there several times. I asked him if I could help. No, 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 he doesn't. When he was at work Monday, you know, the snowplow came through again. And this time they plowed, you know,
the mound into your driveway.
The mounds, you know, of, and now it was hard ice and, you know, things like that. And I thought, I don't want him to have to come home from work and do that. So I'm going to go out and do that. And if anybody has done that, you know that it's a lot of work. But I was thinking about this lesson and thinking, you know, I want to do this for him. You know, this would be, so he won't have to do it. And of course, if I'm going to do it for him, I don't need any credit for it, right? So, yeah, right? So he comes home and we're talking and he goes, oh, I was glad to see that the driveway was all melted down. Okay. Here was the question, right? Who did I do that work for? And even though I had been all the way through this, you know, oh, I'm going to do this for him. This is about him. This is about him. Man, it was like, I did have to clear the... You know, it was like...
Just FYI.
Yeah, just FYI. Just so you know, it didn't all melt. And I said, just look across the street. And, you know, right there, it was like, wow. So, I see what I was really doing. My work was really for me, right? I needed... It was about me looking good, me being great, right? Me... Right? So you start asking those kind of questions about work, and we start seeing what happens. Work is either worship or idolatry. One of the two. Mm-hmm. Heather.
Question, though. Is there a part of that where you really, like, if it's an act of love towards someone, and you're wanting them to actually know... So that they can.
Why not? Didn't you do partially, you know, so that he'd know you care for him?
It was both.
Does that
mean it's always 100%?
Nope. It's never black and white, right? It's never black and white. And I think one thing we've learned here is there is no such thing as black and white. There just isn't. It's gray. But you pretty much know, if you're honest, that some of that comes up. Like I knew it was coming up, and it was like I couldn't stop it. I've got to let you know that I did this. Because the thing is, if it really was for him so that he didn't have to shovel again, I don't need credit for that. I don't need credit for that. And I don't need him to know I did it, because my whole thing is I want him to have a break. Right? If I want him to know I love him, there might be other issues about it, right? But that's really not what I wanted. I wanted a break from him, right?
Yeah.
Isn't there, like, some saying or, like, something like the best way to give is to give anonymously or, the, like, something? Do you know?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
So it'll be interesting how deep this can go for us. So I want us to think about that. Now I want us to go back to talk about work is worship. Right? So work as worship. It's something that we have kind of gotten away from, and we're going to see right here in these passages how that we got away from that.
Oh, let me say, Joel.
Yeah.
It would have been like, the sun is not shining that hard. Yeah. There's no way. I would not have given that enough.
Yeah, it's tough. It's really tough. So the necessity of work. We have to work, we all have to work, in order for the world to be transformed, right? There is a need for everyone to work, to create new, to maintain. It is actually what we were made to do. There has to be a variety of work, right? It has to be all different. Everyone has to work. And so we see in the end of chapter 3, that everyone contributes in a different way, right? Some of them gave money. Well, here's the interesting thing about that. At that time, that place, Jerusalem, Judah, what was called Heyud, was not dealing with coins. The only place that coins came from, that money, payment came from, was Persian government. So people who were giving money were working for the Persian government. People who were giving food, they weren't buying it at the grocery store. They were raising it, right? The people who were giving oil, maybe their neighbors raised the olive trees, but they were doing the pressing of the oil. The what else did they give? Food, drink,
wine.
Drink, wine. Somebody was tending those grapes. Somebody was planting them. Somebody was raising or tending them. Somebody was then putting them in the Gideon's little vat there and stomping on them. Right. Lots and lots of different ways they were giving. Once they gave all of that to buy the material, then it says they all worked. And do you think they all did carpentry? No. There were carpenters, there were stone people, there were people who were laborers that were carrying the things. There were all sorts of laborers. They couldn't just do it with just carpenters. They couldn't do it with just stone cutters. They also couldn't do it with just thinkers, right? They couldn't build the temple with just the priests and Levites. They couldn't build the temple with just the supervisors, which were the Levites. They couldn't build the temple without all sorts of work being done, right? And was any work more important than another? Was it more important that the Levites were there directing than it was the people who were tending the vines over there, away from the temple, so that there could be grapes, so that somebody could use them to make wine, so that somebody could use them to give drink to the workers? Who is more important? Mm-mm. Nobody, right? All of that. All of the work, all the varieties of work, had to happen in order for the temple to be built. So varieties of work are important. All varieties of work. We need everybody. How I view other people's work will also give me an indication of where my heart is, right? So there are people's work that perhaps I view as less important, right? What would you say? What jobs would you say you view as less important?
I have a good story. My boyfriend is a manager of a restaurant. It's right on Michigan Avenue. It's a really great restaurant, but people so often he'll say like, "Oh, I'm in the restaurant industry," and then their response will be like, "But what do you really want to do?" And he's like, "I was a hospitality management major. This is exactly what I want to do." But people have this posture of like,
yes.
"Oh, you're only in the industry because you can't get to where you want to be." And well, then for him, it's like this battle of pride of
yes,
wanting
yes,
to
right.
like earn
right.
people's validation, right. but him being like, "Oh, this is really."
Exactly. And that's so true, right? Mm-hmm. That we have these ideas that some work is more important mm-hmm. than other work. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that a little bit more because it gets down to really the nitty gritty.
What about the opposite? That you feel that some of these college presidents are overpaid and not doing a good job, and yet they get all
who
the
would you be referring
all
to
the
Pat?
Money and all the perks. I mean, you know, it's not that we often look down on lower people.
Uh-huh.
We often tear down
uh-huh.
higher people.
Yep. There's a lot in this idea of work is worship, right? The way we view other people's work and the way we support other people's work, right? Mm-hmm. And the way we complain about that. We don't like that Mr. Bruder is being paid all of our money to leave. What do we do about that if work is worship? So we have to think through some of these things. So there's a lot of issues here, considering that work is what we do all the time. And all sorts of work that is what we do. The fact is that not only do we need everybody's work, but we also need a common goal. It needs to be for the common good, that there's unity. This is what the building here of the temple is telling us here. They had one goal, and their goal was to make sure that the presence of God was visible and tangible so that everyone could enter into his presence. That was the goal of temple building. That is the goal of our temple building, to make sure that the presence of God is visible and tangible so everyone else can enter into it, that they can experience God's presence. That's the common good that all work is supposed to be about. It's the common work, the common good that Genesis talks about, that Eden talks about, that we were created to be. So what then I need to talk about then is the theology of work. The fact is that everything is spiritual. Everything. Everything we do is spiritual. Work, first of all, gives us purpose as image bearers. We are image bearers. That's our identity. If we're trying to restore and rebuild our identity, then we need to talk about work because it's the purpose. It's what God gave us to be able to be image bearers. He gave it to us in Eden. We often think about work as being given outside of Eden, right? But work was given inside of Eden. In Genesis 1 and 2, God gave Adam and Eve both work to do, right? What is that work? Okay, so we know that from Genesis, this is the work that he gave us to do. And he gave it to us in a vulnerable sharing of his work. That's sharing his power, his work. He said, share it with me. I'm giving this to you. Come and share it. Come join with me so that you can bear my image, so that you can represent me and show people what it is like to be in connection with me. It's to serve his purpose of unlocking the potential of everything he created. So remember that God created everything good. He did not create everything finished. He created things, started off and said, okay, now you continue on with my work. Unlock the potential of everything I've created. Because what he intended was that Eden would grow, right? From a small garden to what?
City.
A city garden. That's what he intended. It's the story we have in Genesis and the finishing to Revelation. That's what he's intending, that he would allow us to open up the potential of the things he created. And we see that. If we think about civilization now from where it was at the beginning, we see that mankind has done that, right? We've really realized a lot of potential that things have. We have not created anything that wasn't already here. We've opened up potential. Now, we've done the reverse, too. We've stifled creation as well. But it is what he intended us to do with work. It connected us with him and with others. So this work is a great thing that he actually gave us to do. He gave us talents and gifts so that we could do for others what he wants to do for us. Again, remember community? He wants to restore us using community to community. Remember, community is that cohort, that Trinitarian relationship that he is, and he uses work to allow us to do that because that's how he did it. So that work is being reflective of who he is. It's bearing his image. He worked. He's sharing his work with us. Come and join with me, and you'll get to do that with me. It's like making partner. You know, if you're in the law industry, those are the buzzwords, right? I made partner. But that's what God says for us. You've made partner. And this is what you get to do. You get to do my work. You get to unleash all the potentials that is there. And you keep going, and it keeps growing, and it keeps growing. The good work, when it says we were created in Christ Jesus for good works, this is what he's talking about. Good works of naming, intending, and making space to flourish. Now, let's look at our job chart that we've created here. Just give me some ideas of how each of these might name or tend or make space to flourish, or maybe a lot of them. So carpooling.
All of them.
Yeah, all of them do, but just tell me how. How does carpooling either tend or name or make space to flourish?
Oh, time of connection.
Okay.
Like you can.
Yeah.
What's relationship building?
Right. Okay. So you can use it for relationship building. Mm-hmm. How does specifically carpooling, does it name worth?
You're worthy of my time to take you to point A, from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. How does it tend?
Mm-hmm. You're taking them to help them grow or be healthy or learn or, you know, mm-hmm. to benefit.
And then you can talk about it and mm-hmm. say, oh, I'm proud mm-hmm. of the way you do that.
So there's lots of potential, right, for pretending in carpool. Just the fact that you carpool. If you say nothing, the fact that you're bringing someone somewhere, not having to trudge through the snow, you're tending them, right? Mm-hmm. Let's take errands. Errands. How does that name work?
Thankless.
What?
It's an invisible, you know, it's one of those jobs that maybe doesn't get recognized.
And you're right. How does it name worth?
You're providing services for someone yeah. mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. can't do it or is somewhere else or hasn't got the time. And you're mm-hmm.
you pretty can name worth with the people you're interacting with mm-hmm. on yeah, your errand. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep, mm-hmm. yep. So both, right? What you're going to find in all of these is it names worth because you're doing it for someone, mm-hmm. but in the midst of it, you could also be naming worth. So the foundation can be naming, but also within it you can. Can you do an errand without naming worth?
I suppose you could. You could be bitter about it.
Oh, yeah, right.
Time.
I'm right.
To have to do this. Why do you have to be on this guy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What does that tell you about your heart?
It's I don't
that you're doing a job with you as the center. Right?
Therapy.
That it's about you. Yeah. But it's about you, right? It's not about another. I can do my errands either naming worth. I can do them by to tend somebody, right? My errands can be to go and see if someone's okay, go to see if bring somebody something. Buy them socks because they're out of socks. That can be tending, right? I can also do it not tending, though. I can do it because it's my obligation, because I have to, right? Then it's about mm-hmm. me. How do I, okay, in any of these, can you find any of them that you can say for sure that's making space for someone to flourish?
I'd say carpooling. We take our kids to these places to allow them space to do their thing, they
okay.
love.
Okay, good. Okay.
Coaching.
Coaching.
Coaching or teaching.
And how's that? How does it do that?
Well, you're trying to help them reach a potential. It's mm-hmm. in them mm-hmm. to yep. nourish them and
yep.
help them to,
yep.
to grow better.
That yep. was mine specifically because I'm leading a practice for the high school band. So it's providing that space, like they're leading, they're mm-hmm. like practicing being leaders, worship leaders. So just like that's giving them space to flourish.
Right. Mm-hmm. right. How could you do these things and not give them space to flourish?
Tell me exactly how to
do
it.
I dictate my way is my way.
Control everything.
Yep. We narrow in, right?
Yeah.
This is how you're going to do it, and this is the right way to do it, and this is the only way to do it. Who's it about?
Me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you see that everything we do has the potential to be worship or idolatry?
Talking about this, I see myself having done kind of both, where I was stopping it, and then I let God open my eyes. And it was yesterday, I was on a flight coming back from the West Coast, and it was kind of a long day of flying. And we finally arrived in Chicago, and when we were getting off the plane, you know how you always have those people who come from the back and they want to push through, and everything, you know, and it's like kind of like the person in the wants to drive on the side of the road because they're special. And anyway, this woman was coming through, and I could hear these people kind of getting angry, and you know, everybody was kind of mad. And she comes up behind me. My first thought was, "No, I'm before her." That was honestly, that was my first thought. I'm before her. And she made a comment about,
my flight, you know, leaves. I have a flight that leaves at, I don't know, it was like an hour and 20 minutes from then. I don't want to miss my flight. And I was turned around and I said, not in a, it wasn't in a sincere, nice way. I started off saying, no, you know, you're going to be fine for your flight. And there was something in the way she looked at me that it just stopped me. And then I just looked at her and I went, where are you flying to? And then she told me, and it was kind of like that whole, all of a sudden she told me her story. And everything changed, and it was so, and then I ended up helping, I ended up helping her off the plane. I showed her to the next gate. You know, it was like she told me her story. And I don't know, it just, I remember I was leaving the airport last night just thinking, wow, I was a part of helping her story, helping her, when I really at first was just going to stop her from going before me.
So that what we see is that when I use whatever I do as worship, I tend someone, I name their work, all of a sudden, I'm ready for restoration, right? Do you see how intricate they are and how interweaved they are, that when I view who I am, submitting to God, worship, whatever I do, being worship, then all of a sudden it gets restoration, and now we get to see restoration in both, right? It all of a sudden expanded community, right? It expands our restoration, and we have this great joy. But we wanted to block that off. I want what I want because really I deserve this, right? That's really where it comes. I deserve to be first because I was here first. So that's how the world works. And God's trying to say, but I'm actually made you to be like me, who actually steps aside and gives up everything so that you can be restored. And you're like me. Don't you want to be who you actually were made to be?
It reminds me of like when we plan the weddings for our children. That one.
yeah, we talked about that, right?
Yeah.
Planning weddings, yeah. Where's Taylor?
I'm right here.
Yeah. So how are all the people in your life helping you?
I just made a joke about eating my family. Okay, what's the question?
How are the people in your life doing their jobs around your wedding? Can you tell? You don't have to give names or anything. But can you tell there's some people doing their jobs as idolatry? It's
yes.
About them.
Yeah.
Okay. What about you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We are all involved in this with everything we do. It is always a choice between worship or idolatry. It's always a choice, no matter what we're doing. But I want us to look at these things, and this is what that small little book about, from Brother Lawrence is talking about. Mm-hmm. Practicing the presence of God here. Who is this about? I've been made as his image bearer, and if I want full restoration, then I willingly, physically submit to him saying, okay, I'm going to restore you. Do the dishes. Do them for your family. Don't do them for what you're going to get out of it. How many of you sit down at the dinner table, you've made a dinner, and no one says anything about it, and you're like, once again, made dinner, no one liked it, or no one said anything, or no one appreciated me. Mm-hmm. I mean, as soon as that comes up in your spirit, you know, that was idolatry I was doing. I made this meal in an idolatrous way.
And transactional, too.
Transaction, which is exactly what transaction means, right? Mm-hmm. Transaction is always idolatry. So does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Thousand Gifts, I just think that book, that's like the only like key to getting yourself free of that.
Yeah, right.
It has been like hugely free. Yeah.
Is to begin to say, wait, God's restoring me here. Mm-hmm. This is a gift that I get to join him. Mm-hmm. in restoring others, and in restoring others, restoring community, it restores me. I mean, it's amazing the things that we block away from ourselves because we don't want to submit to our jobs, submit to God by the things we do.
But there's another little thing there, though. When you prepare a big meal to please somebody, it's nice to know that they're pleased.
It is nice.
So
yep.
It's not that you need to receive that as you are praised. You like to know that you were successful in pleasing.
Yep. Mm-hmm. But if you're requiring it, if it's...
They give you a burp, is that good?
Okay, and you know what? Yolanda, that's actually a really good comment because...
You like to share the good things. I mean, you really do.
You do like to share things. But somebody's reaction to your stuff may be something different. It may not fit your picture. You wanted certain... If you're a word person, you wanted words. Mm-hmm. I don't get a lot of words. Mm-hmm. But I am aware of the thanks in different ways. Mm-hmm. And we have to be willing to allow people to express in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. That's also part of the worship. The variety of gifts, the variety of jobs... We have got to appreciate, and really, and there's so much that goes deeper and deeper and deeper, as you see, when we don't realize, when we don't value everything and everyone as an image bearer who's unique, we begin to put them in, well, you didn't thank me this way. So there is a lot of that. Yeah, it's nice to be appreciated. It's nice to hear the words. There's nothing wrong with wanting that. What I'm saying is, if that's your primary reason, you will know it when it just irritates you, right?
It's like someone asking you, you know, if they make a dish and then they say, so how did it taste?
Yeah.
Well, if you're a foodie,
right,
you're going to you know, make suggestions, and then, again, you're going to see that.
Right, right, right,
so
right, right.
It's like, okay, then
you're going to want to know. Yeah. I just think that's better way to have
Well, and remember.
I think it's also an interesting application for parenting. You know, like I have from a kindergarten up through high schooler, you know, but the theology of work for children, giving them space, you know, like I really like to cook, but now because I'm carpooling or I'm doing this, I can't always. So I know I called my eighth grader and I said, oh, honey, you got to start the chili. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I said, well, the recipe's sitting there. You know, call me if you need. Golly, she made this massive pot of chili.
You gave her space.
Yeah. To the top.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Right.
I couldn't believe it. Like, she really did it.
Yeah. You,
she was surprised.
And you asked. but here's what you did. The first thing you did is you named worth in her.
Yeah, you can do,
you can do this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I give someone a job
and
back off, I name worth.
Yeah.
When I give them a job and don't back off, I don't name worth. I actually do the opposite.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And I did start to kind of correct the onion choppings.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got home in time for that.
So there's so much in here. I want to get through this, but I want us to begin to think about the things we do very differently. Work reflects God because it's what he does, right? He vulnerably shares power, and maybe you were vulnerably sharing power with her. You might have had to have shared it, but God put you in that position, right?
Yeah.
I want you to share power with your daughter.
Yeah,
yeah, this is huge. But he wants us to continue his work, to expand his work. But also, when I work as worship, it incarnates love. Because naming, intending, and creating space to flourish is love incarnated. It's exactly what God does with us.
Will you say that again, Jill? Work,
work incarnates love. It puts flesh to love.
Just want to make sure I'm ready.
But also, work belongs to his rhythm. And the rhythm happens to be a 6-to-1 ratio.
A what?
A 6-to-1 ratio.
6-to-1 ratio.
So that we are working a lot, but we're also resting. And when we talk about work and rest and that rhythm, the work is that He wants the garden to continue to grow and flourish. He wants it to continue to grow. He doesn't want us to work one day and go, done. Work really, really hard so I don't have to work tomorrow. That kind of mindset. No, work, 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 work six times. Then, that Sabbath day, it's stand back and celebrate the fact that God has worked through you. That you have gotten to partner with God in naming and tending and making space to flourish. That you got to connect with God, let him breathe into you, and you breathe out to others. That's part of the Sabbath, is celebrating. A lot of times we think about Sabbath as now I get to do what I want to do, which means my work probably hasn't been worship. Sabbath is that celebration of, I got to be partner with God. I got to do this, and look what God did as he breathed into me. And I got to be part of the flourishing of Eden. And we also need to recognize that work is a blessing, that it was a gift in Eden, that God worked and created for the sheer joy of it. And he gave that power to you to be joyful, actually, in work. He gave man his work so that we could partner with him, that we could join with him to grow what he had started to do. It's a blessing. Work is a blessing. All of our little jobs, carpooling is a blessing. I mean, do you need to say this to yourself? Doing the dishes is a blessing. I almost said talking on the phone is a blessing. See what happens? It comes right down and you go, yeah, I didn't see that as a blessing because I don't like to do that. So I don't use it as worship. Paying bills is a blessing. Bathing is a blessing. Laundering is a blessing. Teaching is a blessing. Being on the school board is a blessing. Being a mom is a blessing. Meeting, coaching, making chocolate, cleaning is a blessing. Here's an interesting thing. I'll bet you every one of us could put these in a hierarchy, though, right? Yeah. Yeah, see, I don't think that would be tough for me. I'll eat it. I don't want to make it. You know I don't want to be in the kitchen. And talking on the phone would be the last piece. But we all have these hierarchies, right? Oh, I can worship in that way. But if you're going to make me talk on the phone, I am not worshiping that way. But then it gets to the heart, right? Oh. So God gave you that gift to connect with people. I mean, think about it. That's a place where man was able to open up the potential of things God created. That we can communicate, that I can communicate with Christian in Nashville, that I can text him. He just texted me this morning. I mean, wow, what a blessing that is. We can actually name people's worth with that, right? And I know that if I actually answer people's phone calls, that I've named worth in them. Everybody else knows it too, right? Because you know if I answer the phone. But do you see, like, everything? There is no hierarchy here. All of these can be worship and are meant to be worship. So this is what's happening in the end of 3 and in some of 5 as they're building. But what happens then when we get to Ezra 4? What's the very first line of Ezra 4? The enemies came. Okay. So, really interesting section here on the enemies. So, we have the enemies of Judah and Benjamin hearing that they're building a temple. And the first thing they do is ask,
let us build with you.
If what? Yeah, let us build with you. And because they aren't allowed to build with them, they do what? They discourage them, frighten them, and then hired counselors against them to frustrate their counsel. Interesting. Yeah.
Were they genuine in their
request? Well, we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
The first thing we see is that work is transaction. So what we're going to see is exactly opposite of what we've just talked about in building the temple, of what God has actually given us, work as a gift. We're going to see the opposite, work as transaction. Instead of work as transformation, I'm building something where people get to be in God's presence, work as transaction. The enemies here want to join in the building of the temple of God. What do you think? Do you think they were sincere here? I want you to think, first of all, who are the enemies?
Maybe a few of them were, but I don't. They were the people of the other tribes that, you know, went to idolatry with Rehoboam. And so that they had been worshiping idols up in the hills and stuff. But they said, I know, but they said, but we had worshiped God, and they had. I mean, they were there.
Okay.
So that they had. So, I mean, I would like to hope that a few of them might have been sincere, but I don't think they were.
But then we have, I think, Cyrus, who God stirred his hearts. Well, mm-hmm. Who's to say mm-hmm. that?
Right.
Heather?
Stir those enemies' hearts, too. Huh?
I think they were probably just trying to win the favor of God being on the par with every other God that they serve. They see some build, you know, some big new project, like, ooh, this is going to be bring the attention of this particular God, which we don't really mm-hmm. think is any better than any other.
Okay, let's go back to who these enemies are. These enemies are actually Samaritans.
Yep.
Okay, so remember what Samaritans are? Samaritans are a mixed breed. They were Israelites mixed with Assyrians. So remember, this is more than a generation. So these are mostly people who are mixed. Either they could be complete Israelites who've stayed in the land, or they could be Samaritans. They're mostly Samaritans. You'll see that as we get down. And the Samaritans are people, and it even says that, we have been sacrificing to him, to God, since the days that Esarhaddon, king of Syria, who brought us up here. Okay, so right there it tells you, these are Samaritans. Because Assyria, king of Syria, brought them down to mix with the people. What we know is that those people, yes, they mixed with people who worship God, who were also idolaters, but also brought their own gods. And so they had a mixed religion. They had we talked about this in Judges, right? They had a syncretized religion so that they had their gods and the God of Israel, both. So now they're saying, well, we worship your God and we want to build. If that is the case, if it's sincere and they really want to build a temple for God, why haven't they already done it? Right? There was no reason for them not to do it. All of a sudden now, the temple's coming up, and Heather's right. Whoa, 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 wait a second. We got to be a part of this, because if we're not, we're going to lose control of how we live here. All of a sudden, this God is going to become bigger. Not just on the par with all the other gods, but he's going to become bigger. There's going to be this big temple. And this temple actually has to do with God being the only God. Are they about that? Is that who they are? No, it is not who they are. If it were, they would have left their Assyrian gods, and they would have left the gods of the Baals, and they would have been worshiping God only. And when the Jews came back from Babylonia, they would have come right to them and said, you know, we're with you. We have been faithful to God, but they haven't. So we know that it's not sincere, okay? So we know that it's not a sincere thing. They really want to join with them so that they maintain control, so that they don't lose their status quo, so that they don't lose the way they have lived, because they know that this building of the temple is going to change things. It's going to change some of the power structure. So they know that. They also, they understand that they need to control things for their good. Remember we talked about work being for the common good, right? So that building the temple is so that anyone can actually enter into the presence of God. And we know the temple does have a court of Gentiles, so they aren't keeping them out. They want them in. Their whole idea is for the common good. The enemy's idea is so that there's disunity, so that it's for their good. And anytime I say, I need to do this for my good, I am putting myself above, more important than someone else. And that's what's happening here. They aren't concerned about the temple being built. They do worship God, the God of the Israelites, as an add-on. He's good for some part of my life. As is my Assyrian God good for another part of my life. They do not believe that one God is good for everything in my life. They want to make sure that they can keep their dualistic lives. I have God stuff, life, part of life, and I have man stuff, parts of life. I want to be able to still have that. I don't really want to be a part of a nation that God is a part of everything. When we think about the paradigm that we live in the midst of, about work, that's what work says. Work says, the paradigm of work in today's life is, why do I work?
To make money, to retire.
Yeah, okay. So what's the essential? I work for
me
or my family, right? I work to make sure that I have what I need. It isn't what work was created for. Work was created for the common good. But our paradigm says, I work for me. I work for my fulfillment so that I can pay my bills so that I can do this. That's very different, but it's how we do most of this stuff, right? I do this because it has to be done, and if it's not done, then I'm in trouble. I'm going to be uncomfortable. I'm going to be unhappy. Someone's going to go without, and then that will affect me because they'll be crabby, right? So it goes down into these layers here. It's how they, the enemies there, look at work. It is how the world looks at work. So what we have here, interesting enough, is the secularization of work. What they are saying is that there is a division in life between sacred and secular. That there some things are about God and some things are about man. So that some parts of my life are about God and connecting. That's how they felt. But some things are about me. And we know that because they had other gods. You don't need other gods if everything is about the God of Israel. But if there are some parts of my life that really don't have anything to do with God, then I have secularized my life. I've secularized work. My work then says something about me. Interesting, when we get into the New Testament, we talk about, well, even the Old Testament, we talk about a bondservant. What do we know about a bondservant?
They'll take you to jail or if you break the bond.
Oh, no.
No,
not that
guy.
You've
given your
wife. Right. How do you know someone's a bondservant? Does anyone know this?
They have their ear pierced.
They have their ear pierced with a big hole in their ear. It was voluntary. When somebody saw a bondservant, when they saw this big hole in the ear, what was the first thing they knew?
They're not for sale.
The first thing they know is he has got a fantastic boss. Because a bondservant voluntarily gives himself for life to his boss because his life is better that way. So a bondservant, work is about my boss. I submit myself because he's so awesome, because he actually provides me with life. The paradigm that we live under, that all of humanity lives under, is that work is about me. It says something about me. Work gets me a new identity, right? We've talked about these things about identity. Whereas God says, I'm giving you the identity of image bearer, and here's how you're going to be able to be an image bearer. Work. I'm giving you work. I'm giving you the ability to name and to tend and to make things flourish. But when I decide work is about me, then I can get a new identity. I don't have to be an image bearer. It's about what do I want to do? What will fulfill me? What will make me look good, feel complete? When work is about me, I elevate the individual choice and expression above shared life. It's about me. What can I do? And that's how we get the ranking then of jobs. Because if it's about me, I need to rank it. I'm interested in being separate, better than you. And let's go through these kind of rankings. We laugh when a child says, "What do you want to be when you grow up, Johnny?" What do we laugh at when he says something?
A garbage man.
Right? Right away, "I want to be a garbage man." And we all laugh. And inside, if you're the parent, you fear.
Cringe.
Right? Oh, no. He wants to be a garbage man.
I want to work at McDonald's.
I want to work at McDonald's. And Natalie, what would be the thing? Well, what do you really want to do? Because working at McDonald's can't be an ambition. No. That's not good. Do you see what's happening? Work is about me. Work is about, it says something about me rather than it says something about the one I'm bearing image of. It says, I can't possibly be all I am in this kind of a job. Isn't that interesting? I can't be all I am. Isn't that a McDonald's? Be all you can be? What is it? Oh, Army. McDonald's, Army.
It's Burger King that you can have at your wedding.
Oh, okay, yes. So, of course, we feed into this, right? We separate jobs into categories. We separate blue collar and white collar, right? It's interesting because I'm dealing with this with my son. And, you know, you guys, I've talked about this before. You know, you send them to Wheaton College, you know, a theology degree and a philosophy degree, and he becomes a furniture maker. And he's Christian was always my GQ guy. I mean, he was, you know, he's been asked to model. Well, he has modeled. He's done all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden now he's asking for, you know, Carhartt work clothes. And he goes, "Yeah, and that's all I wear now." And he, as his mom, I'm like, literally had this conversation. Well, can't you kind of do the white collar when you're out of work and the blue collar when you're in work? What does that say? Like, oh.
Oh, you mean dress like it?
Dress like it. Yeah. I have this, like, this is really tough for me. And yet, in what he does, he gets to name worth. He gets to do everything he was meant to do. But we've labeled it, right? We've labeled it as blue collar and white collar. And no one has any imagination that they aren't a hierarchy, right? Which one is better? Come on.
White collar,
right? Even people in blue collar jobs know white collar is better, according to our paradigm.
But right? You know what's interesting? We would not want to live in a world where those blue collar jobs didn't exist.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, we want our stuff fixed.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, we wouldn't want people to not be garbage men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's the way we approach them.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Okay, here's another one that
when you do this, it's so much a heart issue, right? Because, like, I look at a teacher that says they don't know, they know the backstory, so maybe that person only aspires to be this big, but they name this potential in them.
Right.
So there's a different reason why they're saying don't do that, do this.
Right,
no,
right.
It always comes back to the heart.
It always comes back to the heart. And that's kind of what we're getting at here, right? One of the other things that we do, particularly who we are, we have a separation between a regular job and ministry. Mm-hmm. Right? Which is better? Just say it. Which is better?
Ministry.
Ministry is better. And I know I'm talking to a room full of people who are in ministry.
There are some people who don't believe that, though.
I know.
Depends
who you ask. But on the whole, in the church, who I'm talking to here, my audience, ministry is better.
But you're supposed to be a minister wherever you are.
Okay, yeah. That's the whole point. But the point is, we make people feel, who aren't in ministry, as if they're not quite doing they're not doing it for the kingdom. They're computer science. They're computer scientists. Well, so what are you doing for the kingdom? Except the fact that the temple could never be built without the people who are doing the things on the farm and all the other things.
Well, and ministry can so become your identity and not identity in Christ.
Yes!
So
it doesn't even absolutely. Like, absolutely.
And it doesn't even just go back to what the computer scientist is doing with computer science, but what he's doing with the community that he's within.
Yeah.
Or she's in.
Yeah. All that. Karen.
We do tend to label people as soon as we know what they do.
Yes.
So my husband and I were talking that when we meet new people, we try not to say, so what do you do?
Yes.
As soon as you know what they do, you kind of go, oh.
Yep.
That
yep.
person is this. And it's really hard not to.
It is. Because it's the paradigm we live in, right? And we need to struggle with this because this is what's happening here. The enemies here, we need to understand what these metaphors are about. These enemies are against building the temple. And what's the temple doing? The temple is saying everybody counts, all your work counts. We can't have a temple without all of it. And they don't really want to be in that kind of a paradigm. They want to keep their paradigm where I have something secular, some things are sacred. America is as secular as you can get because we have the separation. Because we say there are secular things. The fact that we even have the word. We say that there are a secular part of life and there's a sacred part of life. And when we do that with our jobs, when we look at all of these, and most of them are what we would call secular work. But God says they're not. God says everything's spiritual. So the enemy for us in building the temple is ever considering any work as secular, as not being able to be worship. Work in God's paradigm reflects him, right? But in the world's paradigm, work reflects me, right? It says something about me. It validates me. But the problem with that is it validates the individual without validating a social fabric that allows the individual to be. It doesn't validate community when we look at work like that.
Well, and the problem is that it comes and goes.
Yeah.
So then you're tossed around by a promotion or by getting fired, and you're never right. secure.
Right, exactly, exactly. And that's the cool thing about what God has done, right? Your identity as image bearer, it can never change. No matter what you do to it, it can never change. You are always an image bearer. That's the stability we're looking for, but we keep looking for it in what we do. So work reflects me instead of God. If in God's paradigm, work is part of a rhythm, 6 to 1, I work, I work, I work, I work, I work, and then I rest and celebrate. In world's paradigm of work, work begets work. The more work I do, the more I get, right? If I just do more work, I'll get more. I'll bolster my identity up. I'll be more. I'll be more impressive. I'll get more money. It will be about me being built up more rather than community being built up more. It will get me more stuff, more recognition, whatever. And the less I rest, the more important I am. And this is how you know. When you say, oh, how are you doing? And you say, I'm so busy. Why do you say that? Because it bolsters you up. Because in the paradigm we live, that's a badge of honor.
So my sleep should have been on
there. Yeah, yeah, right. Sleep. You're right. Sleep should have been on there. I'll put that back on. We'll put it up right now. Sleep. That's worship, right?
It's being submissive.
It is being submissive to the rhythm, right? It is. But we in our society, if I say I'm so busy, there's a little bit underneath that. It's like, I'm pretty important. What I do is really important. And we say it all the time. And what have I said? I mean, I told you all how busy I was, right, with school. And I've been struggling with that. How do I not say I'm so busy with that if I look at it as worship? And I could tell you, at one point in January when I was in that class, I was not looking at it as worship. I was looking at it as, literally, I was so stressed when I walked out that third class that I was almost in tears. And I thought, what's wrong? And God said, did you even think about me when you were in that class? No, it was all about you. How are you going to possibly get that A? You've just got to do it. You've got to do it. And all of a sudden, my busyness became about me and not, what am I learning how to name here? Am I being named? Am I naming in here? Am I learning how to tend in here? Or am I just wanting to have a good grade so that I come out looking good? That's why I'm so busy. Because I can be busy, literally I can be busy, and it be a joy. And then I don't go, I'm so busy. It's like, wow, I get to do this. So cool. Do you see the difference?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I felt so often when somebody has said to me, I'm busy or my life is full, that they're saying they don't have room.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And
exactly.
I've noticed as I've moved around, that's the way I feel. Like, okay, that's not something.
Right. Right. And that's exactly what it does. It closes doors to community. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that there aren't times where you say, you know, I can't do that now. But I think we all understand that feeling of, you know, and sometimes I do use it as a door closer, right? Instead of saying, you know what, I'm doing this, I love it, can we do it some other time? Or I can't do it right now, but not this, I'm so busy kind of thing. We wear it as this badge of honor. So are we seeing the difference? Sometimes I want to put these in charts because it is the opposite of what God said work is. And if God says work is a blessing and a gift, what do we say work is? A curse. Work is a curse.
Well, I thought of this earlier. It was like, I remember being taught, you know, with the original sin, that man is supposed to work the field. We work because it's a result of our sin.
Sometimes I just want to scream. Are you kidding me? Did you not read Genesis 1 and 2? Where Adam and Eve are working. What's the curse? The curse is that when we work, it doesn't produce fruit. That's the curse. But here's the grace. The grace is that even our work in our sin produces fruit. Last night, actually, our professor started talking about this, and I thought, oh my gosh. She said, think about the grace that our work actually produces fruit. If it weren't grace, when I'm typing on my computer, it would have nothing in common with what I'm actually typing. It would produce nothing, but it's producing words that I'm actually saying, that I'm actually putting on paper. The fact that when I talk to you, you understand, is actually producing something of worth. When I name you, I can actually name you. I can name worth from you. I can actually say, oh, that was so great that you did that. You're so good at that. And I can actually do that. The curse is that I could say that and they wouldn't get nothing out of it. Do you understand that? So we say work is a curse, but it isn't. Work is not a curse, it's a gift. We say work is a curse because we're always looking to get out of it, right? We're always looking for a day off, a vacation, a snow day, retirement, right? I am not enjoying what I have as a gift. I'm looking to the future. We're living in a place that isn't true. Only what's present is true. So when I say work is a curse, then I'm trying to live somewhere else. I want to get out of it. I'm just doing it so that I can get something else, so that I can get to the future, rather than I'm doing it because this is actually me as an image bearer.
Saying though about how I think in our society we look for ways to God work, and my father is like such a really cool example of like this dichotomy, because he worked for NASA, he was in aerospace engineering and retired really young, you know, they retired at 55 or something. They moved to Florida, he played a lot of tennis and went to the gym all the time and was miserable. And so after 2 years, he's back working with a group that, he's got this little community of guys that, I mean, they're doing all this cool stuff. He's like, he's so alive and loves what he does. And now it purely is totally his choice. He doesn't have to do it, but he loves it. He's like, I look at him as, man, you're so busy, but he loves it. He's up early. He's he just, it's so neat to see. Like the goal in our society really is
retirement. And if, think about that. If our goal in our society is to retire, if that's the whole goal, our goal is to not be an image bearer. That's what our goal, that's what we're working toward, not being an image bearer. Now, it doesn't mean that our goal can't be, I'm going to retire from this job so that I can do other things to name and tend. But when my goal is retirement so I can relax and not have to do things, then my goal is not to name and to tend and to make space to flourish. Does this make sense to you? We see work as a means to an end rather than work as our purpose so that we can actually flourish as image bearers. So that's what we see in the enemies. That whole Ezra 4 is what the enemies are trying to do. They're trying to separate secular and sacred. And there just is no such thing. There is no part of life that isn't sacred, that isn't spiritual.
Well, it makes me even think of, like, our, just with our politics, of how often I feel like people tell me, even when they know, like, I'm following Jesus, they will say, like, well, but when it comes to politics, like, you're not supposed to think of that right. in the way that you would vote.
Right.
But, I mean, it is, I mean, that's, like, kind of the posture that people have towards things of, like, you're not supposed to because church and state are separate.
Yeah, right. I mean, we say that all the time, right? Church and state are separate. And that's actually what we're saying is there is a secular part of life and there's a sacred part of life. And it just isn't true. And it is what the enemy is trying to do when we're trying to build the temple. And building the temple means we are naming and tending and creating space for flourishing, that Eden can grow, that God's kingdom can grow. That's all spiritual. When we get to Ezra 6, what we see is that the sons of Israel celebrate. They celebrate the dedication of the house of God with joy. So what's happened here? And let me back up for just a minute, because maybe some of 5 was a little hard to understand. We have the opposition in Ezra 4. And I want you to remember that mostly Old Testament writers, they didn't think linear, first of all. We're very linear thinkers, so much so that we just think that anything else is not true. They didn't think linear. So when they're writing this and they're talking about opposition, they're not talking about a linear opposition. So it may have confused you. What they're doing, what they do as they write, is they write in categories. We're talking about opposition? Well, let's talk about all the opposition. We'll talk about the opposition to the temple, but a big section of 4 is talking about opposition to the wall in the city, which happens much, much later. But the writer of Ezra brought it together because he's talking about opposition. So he's writing thematically. Does that make sense? So when you see some of that, most of that opposition, it says, so then later years, this opposition happened. What he's trying to get you to understand is the opposition is not about they didn't let them build, because that was the opposition in the temple. It was, no, we want to have secular and sacred society. We want to have separate societies. We want to have places where we don't have to consult God about anything and that he doesn't have to be our center, that we can be the center. So that's what you're supposed to get out of the fact that opposition is kind of squeezed in to there. So now when we get to 6, we also want to reflect back to 3 too, because there's celebrations when the foundation of the temple happens, but there's also celebration of when the temple finishes. So what we've done here is we've skirted a lot of years, because the temple actually stopped being built because of the opposition. And it stopped being built for about, oh, I have to go back and remember, I think, 16 years. There was no building going on because of the opposition, and we'll see, because Israel actually succumbed to the paradigm that we're talking about today. That's next week's lesson. That's in Haggai. We're going to find out what was really happening when the building stopped. Now, in 6, we go back to, okay, we're going to come back to building, and we actually build the temple, and we have the celebration. In this celebration, the first thing they do is recount what the king has them do, what Darius, now this is many kings later after Cyrus, what Darius says, okay, I want you to build back the temple. And how are they going to be able to do this now? What's Darius going to give them? Yeah. From the taxes, think about this. It's from the royal treasury, but it's the taxes that the people in all of Judah are paying. All the people in Judah, which means Samaria, which means all those enemies, all of them are paying toward the temple. He not only gives them the tax money, but then he says to Tatnai, the governor who had asked him about this, also make sure that they are supplied with anything they need for the offerings. Anything they need, you're to supply. Give them whatever they need, you are to supply that. Not only that, but you are to supply your cooperation. You leave them alone, you let them build, and you cooperate. Now, yes. Not only if you don't cooperate and everybody in all of Judea doesn't cooperate, I'll take your house and pale you on that. What is happening here is God is affirming there is no such thing as secular and sacred. It's all spiritual. It's all spiritual. And he does this very concretely. He brings state and church together, right? He completely says, no. Everyone is going to be involved in this. The taxes from what other people are doing are going to be involved in this. Now, I want you to think about the repercussions that means for us. That means the temple, our spiritual temple, is also built with people who we don't particularly think belong, right? We need them too. So we cannot put these barriers that say you can't be a part of building the temple because you are. God says it's all spiritual. And I'm restoring them too. And I'm giving them the opportunity to actually come into this. We need physical, material, earthly things to build the spiritual temple. The spiritual temple is on this earth. It is here. Jesus' resurrected body was not all of a sudden spirit only, right? His resurrected body was actually a body. He actually wore clothes. He actually ate food. He actually walked around. He actually had relationships. After he was resurrected, that is part of the spiritual kingdom of God. Physical, material, earthly things. All of it is needed to rebuild Eden into the temple city that we have in Revelation. All of that. Yes, he will shake heaven and earth to shake off all the things that aren't about centering around him. But a lot of it stays. And the physicality stays. We need all of that. We are in helping with God's work of redeeming the value of everything he made. Eden was physical. Eden was very material, very earthy. And it is being restored. And we cannot put that aside. So we have God confirming the fact that everything is spiritual. I mean, I love that he brings together not only the taxes from everybody, but that Tatnai, the governor, comes and it says he immediately goes to work and does all this and makes sure that everything happens. But he also brings what we would term the spiritual encouragers. That would be Haggai and Zechariah. And it tells us there that they came and helped encourage the people. So we have both sides here. The people who we would call secular, we would call pagans, and the people who are God's people. We have both people fighting this, staying in this. We're going to see in Haggai that Israel was actually sitting right there. Yes, part of life is secular. And he has to bring in encouragers for them. No. It's all spiritual. Come on, we got to work on this. We're coming. So we have Haggai and Zechariah, which we will look at next week. It took both to build the temple. It took the spiritual prophets, and it also took Tattenai the governor and all the pagans. It took them both to build the temple. God is affirming everything is spiritual. We then have the celebration. We are called to celebrate, but we are called to celebrate what is. And this is very important because I think we get tripped up here a lot. We notice in here and also back in chapter 3, some of them were crying, right, when they saw the foundation of the temple. There's a couple reasons. One, the people who were crying are the people who saw the first temple. What they saw here was the fact of what they had lost. They're seeing this less grand temple being built, and they're realizing how much they have lost in not having God as their center. That's what they lost. So it's not so much a, oh, this isn't going to be as great. It's, wow, what we lost in not having God as center is a lot. We need to stand at that point too, right, and say, what we lose when we consider that part of our life is about me and about being it's secular, apart from God, we lose a lot. We've lost a lot. But also, now we have in Ezra 6, we have them celebrating, and they count the number of sheep and oxen and everything. And I think she had you look up, right, how much different it was from the Solomon's thing. How much different was it?
A lot.
A lot, right? They all understood. Wow, this is a lot less. And yet, they celebrate. Because the celebration is about the making room for God's presence. That's what must be celebrated. If I don't celebrate whatever room is made for God's presence, I first of all negate the need for process. We talked about this in a couple other Bible studies, that it's process, not finished product, right? It's process, it's the journey of restoration that we're involved in. If we don't celebrate what is, if it's smaller than we wanted it to be, when my restoration or someone else's restoration, and usually it's someone else's restoration, right? Well, that's not enough. They should be farther along here, right? We wanted them to be better. We had a picture for how they should be restored. And we think it should be better. So we're not celebrating until it's there, right? We do this all the time, right? My mom was really famous for, she expected us to get all A's all the time. And if we came home with A's, there was no celebration. And I would just be devastated, like, Lori got a candy bar for every A that she, well, you are expected to have. This is, perfection is what is expected here. It's nothing you couldn't do. So I want you to be at that place where you're finished and complete. I want to celebrate there. I'm not celebrating the steps here. But we do this with each other, right? If someone is being restored in some way, what can you think about? Think about ways that you want someone restored or yourself restored. And they get one piece restored, right? They get something restored. Today, they didn't yell at their kids, whatever the restoration was. And you're like, well, you know, we'll have to wait and see, you know, right? We don't like to celebrate the small. What Ezra's saying here is, no. We celebrate whatever space is being made for God's presence. Whatever space is being made for God to be the center, we celebrate that. If we don't, we're denigrating God's work, because God is restoring now, every one of us. He is doing that. What happens is, when we celebrate only completion, we don't celebrate growth. Completion means death. It's growth that we're to be celebrating. And when I don't celebrate growth, what happens is I slow growth. I stop it in people, right? Well, really? You're not going to celebrate the one step I made? Why go on, right? You're not going to celebrate until I'm at the end, until I'm complete? Well, I'm never going to be complete. We must celebrate every space that is given over to God as center. Every space. And that doesn't mean just in other people. It means in us. Where we're the hardest, right? We don't celebrate the space we made for God today to be center. We don't celebrate that all of these things I did in idolatry worship, but in my carpool, I was worshiping. I literally was doing it, being an image bearer, to give someone some tending.
I was kind of stuck on where you went earlier when you mentioned all different types of people working on the temple, people who maybe had no appearance of God in their life, and people who yes. did. And I just, that's where they're comfortable. Yeah. You know, that's why it was okay to happen, because that's where they're just going to start brushing shoulders with someone maybe had more spiritual life right. than you. And I mean, I've seen it in my own life. Even this weekend, we had a Super Bowl party with a couple families that don't have much spiritual life going on, right? But we had a couple of these little growth moments where, mm-hmm. oh, they're at a Super Bowl party, and they start asking spiritual questions. Yes. And it was neat for my kids to see it, and we got to talk about it later, like, wow, that made space, because they were comfortable being in our house, because it was a Super Bowl party. It wasn't a church growth
right.
group.
Right.
But then they started asking spiritual questions, and so it was
yeah.
fun for all of us to be like, oh, this
it is, right?
We need to keep this up, yeah.
Yeah, that is a really part of that fun picture. So do you understand how important it is to celebrate? It's what Sabbath is about. We're actually supposed to do it once a week. Mm-hmm. We're actually supposed to celebrate God as center, that like somebody made space to have God as center in one place. Celebrate that for us and for each other. Remember our community. If my community isn't celebrating with me, I'm not going to have a lot of space to flourish. We also need to understand the unseen picture here. And we're going to get more of that in Haggai. We're going to see what God says about this temple. We see them. It says that they sacrificed one ram for each tribe. Well, that's interesting. How many tribes are there?
There's supposed to be
12. How many are in the land right now?
Two.
Probably only two. Probably only Judah and Benjamin are there in the land. But they're sacrificing one for each. Because they know by promise there will be 12 tribes again. They're celebrating not just what they see, but what is true underneath. The backstory, right? Yes, covenant. God has promised he will do that. We also see then that apparently some others are joining them. So some others from not the people who came back, but some others in the land come and join them. We have that in the end of 6 here. 21. The sons of Israel who returned from exile and all those who had separated themselves from the impurity of the nations of the land joined them to seek the God of Israel. The unseen picture is there are going to be others that will join. The restoration is bigger than we know, than we see. When I name someone, I don't know where that goes. I don't know what happens in that person's life because I've named them. I don't know what restoration God does and uses that, but also what passes on from there. Maybe I went to the grocery store and a clerk was being kind of crabby. And I just said to her, I'm sorry, you know, it must be really tough with all these people coming in. I've just named her, right? I've said, wait, you're worth something. It's not what you're doing here. It's who you are. You're worth something, and you're probably tired. Maybe what happened there is she felt like, well, somebody saw me. And now she can see the next customer behind me. I don't know what God is doing with the restoration, but he never stops his restoration with just me. And he never stops it with just who I involve myself with, because all of us have a connection everywhere. So the unseen is everywhere. When I am allowing God to restore me, when my heart is soft because I'm saying he's the center and I'm submitting, I don't know everything that my restoration does for everybody else. But I can celebrate that I know he's restoring me and he's using me in my restoration. There's so many of the New Testament verses that just talk about this. When he says, you know, let your light shine, let your good works be seen so that you are glorified. No, that my Father in heaven is glorified. So that my Father in heaven is actually reflected and somebody gets to see the presence of God. Because I let my light shine. I was an image bearer. I named, I tended, I whatever, for someone else. We notice here, though, that they talk about impurity a lot in verses 20 and 21, and that they separate themselves from impurity. This Passover impurity is the separating from secularity. It's the separating from the idea that some things are secular and some things are sacred. So that the impurity of the nations is that there is a paradigm that some things are just about me and some things are about God. So we tend to think that when we talk about the nations or the world, that it's all ungodly. It's not that. Because we're made to worship a God, we do. We all worship. The problem, the impurity, is that when we talk about gold and the impurity of gold, right, it's mixed in with gold. And it comes out. The impurity is that they're combining. Oh, there's some hearts that are for me and some hearts that are for God. They're living as if God is relevant for some parts of their lives, but not others. And this is pretty much how we all live, right? God is very relevant for a lot of my life. God is especially relevant when things are going horrible, right? He's really helpful there. I can really count him there. When things are going great and I've done a great job and things are turning out right, God isn't quite as relevant. That's what he's talking about. This is what we're separating from. No. God is relevant in all of these things. So I need you to understand that, because remember, he's growing them up. He's showing them concretely a separation from a people. But when we're grown up, we see it's a metaphor. It's separation from a paradigm, not a people. We need to understand that because we don't want to come at it, which actually they will happen. This is why the Jewish nation looks like it does when Jesus' time is. They held on to the concrete instead of allowing themselves to grow into the metaphor of what it means to separate. And so we will separate from anyone who is secular or pagan, right? God is saying, no. I'm teaching you concrete first. Then we have the metaphor. Then we have the reality of bigger, that we're separating from secularization, from that paradigm. And then they have, so that's, we have this celebrating the Passover by doing that. And we have the 7 days of feasting of the unleavened bread, which comes after Passover. Feasting with joy. Feasting always means to partake of. All of life is spiritual. When anything is 7 days, it means complete, everything, your whole life. I partake of everything in my life being spiritual, of everything in my life being a place of naming and tending and being an image bearer, making space for others. All of what I do matters. All of what I do matters. It's either idolatry or it's worship. If in every job I do, I'm naming, I'm tending, I'm making space, then I'm worshiping. This is this pray without ceasing. Because remember, it's this communion, is this connection. So that when I'm carpooling and I'm doing it out of being an image bearer for others, I'm praying without ceasing. I'm worshiping. When I am in that paradigm, I'm ready for restoration. My heart is completely soft for restoration. And it begins happening all over the place. And it's not quite so hard. God doesn't have to, like, come on, we're going to do this. Work is worship. When I work, when it's as not worship, it's when I resist restoration, and it's when it becomes harder and harder, but God doesn't give up. He still will be working on our restoring. But our hearts need to be ready and willing and soft. And we do that when we submit in physical ways. These are all physical things we do. And it's important. Everything we do matters. Father, I thank you that you gave us work to join with you, to partner with you, to open up all the potentials of what you have created, that we get to create all sorts of new things, that we get to name with you, that we get to tend, that we get to make space for others to flourish. Father, I thank you that we can see all the things we do mattering, whether we're taking out the garbage or whether we're building rocket ships, whether we're preaching in a church or we're tending to a little baby. All of these things are essential in building your spiritual house. May you dwell in the center of the houses we build today with everything we do. In Jesus' name, amen.